I'm Molly Wansell.
And I'm Geoffrey Wansell.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we have been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
And that's what's prompted us to launch this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wansell and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wansell.
Hello everyone, welcome back. Thank you for listening. Hope you're enjoying the new season as it quietly gets going. In this sort of half light of lockdown, or half lockdown, or not really lockdown, or something or other. And Molly just arrived wearing a new dress and she said, I don't have anywhere else to go except here, which I thought was very touching.
Well, I might as well get dressed up to see you.
I was very flattered, I have to say.
It's the real social highlight of my week.
But you have been away.
I have been busy this week. I went to Norfolk and I swam in the sea.
Good Lord.
Do bear in mind, listeners, that this was recorded on a heatwave day and it was absolutely glorious. Yes.
Was it terribly busy? Was it packed?
It was pretty busy. It's a huge sandy beach. I think even on the hot days, most people would be in Spain or elsewhere.
A friend's going to Greece on Monday. Crikey, that'll be hot.
Boy, yes, that will be hot. What are we doing today, Dad?
This particular episode is very much a passion of mine. Because for a variety of reasons back in the 90s, I was the official biographer of the British playwright Terence Rattigan, who was a considerable talent and had a great many hits, notably The Winslow Boy, The Browning Version, The Deep Blue Sea, and Separate Tables. But Rattigan's last play premiered in his last year, 1977. He died that year. It was called Cause Célèbre, and it was based, as indeed The Winslow Boy was, on a law case. And so this is the story of murder at the Villa Madeira.
Well, here we go then. Murder at the Villa Madeira.
This concerns a passion, a real passion. Alma Rattenbury, who is the principal character in this drama, is the only child of a professional singer called Francis, who'd appeared, believe it or not, the Doyley Cart in London.
I need to explain what the Doyley Cart is.
Doyley Cart Opera Company started at the Savoy, or started just before the Savoy Theatre opened, and was famous for producing Gilbert and Sullivan operettas. In fact, Doyley Cart was part of the reason for the building of the Savoy Hotel in London's Strand. Now, Frances never became a star, and in 1891 she moved to British Columbia in Canada with her husband Walter, who was a printer. Alma, their child, their only child, was born in 1892, and she had what could only be described as precocious musical talent. At one point, when she was 18, she was called Canada's musical prodigy. She played the piano with a fluency that simply bowled Canada away.
Oh.
However, in 1913, at the age of 22, she married an Irish aristocrat who'd gone to British Columbia, Victoria, to start a new life. He was called Caledon Dolling. But at the outbreak of war in 1914, they both moved back to London. Alma went to work at the War Office and Dolling joined the Royal Welsh Fusiliers. So far, so conventional, you would say.
Mm-hmm.
Sadly, Dolling was killed in France in 1916 and Alma became a widow at 24. And she decided to join the ambulance corps in France, where she served with considerable courage and won herself the Croix de Guerre. So we're not talking about some flighty flibbertigibbet. Here is a picture of her in a book called The Fatal Passion.
Fatal Passion of Alma Rattenbury.
By Sean O'Connor. And if you haven't had a look at it, I do highly recommend it. It's beautifully done.
She looks like she's punchy.
Yes? There are lots of pictures, but...
Are there pictures inside?
I think so. I can never remember.
There are a few, yeah.
However, what also happened to Alma in the wake of her tragedy was that she became, how can I put it, a bit of a naughty girl.
I'm really worried what that definition of that is.
And in when she got back to London in 1918, she started an affair with the writer Tom Pakenham. Now, Tom Pakenham was a relative, an earlier relative of the great Pakenham family, which included, of course, Lord Longford, Frank Longford. Very many Irish connections. At that point, Tom Pakenham was married. He was a guards officer and he was married, but that didn't seem to put Alma off for one moment. Poor old Tom then got a divorce. When he was a writer, he didn't have any money, and so he was struggling to pay the alimony, and in the end couldn't manage it. So Alma took her son, she'd had a son with Tom, called Christopher, and went back to British Columbia, back where, from whence she'd come. Because remember, she was born in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Not long after her return to Victoria, the capital of British Columbia, she met really a rather famous architect called Frank Rattenbury. He was born in Yorkshire, but he'd actually worked and made his reputation in Canada. And he designed the Vancouver Art Gallery. Now, Frank was considerably older than Alma. A good 20 years, a bit more, to be fair. And indeed, he was a friend of Alma's very forceful mother, Frances. Anyway, Frances Rattenbury was married when they met to a woman called Florrie. They don't have names like that anymore, do they? You wouldn't...
Florence,
yes.
I went to school with a Florrie.
Yes, you did. I remember. You went to a party with her as well. I remember.
Oh, yeah,
that.
They had a big party. That was like the first big party I ever went to and drank pims.
Big party. You went in a minibus. Yes.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I wore a dress not dissimilar colour to this.
Good Lord.
I'm very different
that.
Style.
I didn't remember that. Okay. Anyway, Alma clearly wasn't afraid to set her cap sights at Rattenbury, who was considerably older than she was, as I said, and was quite well off. She took to going round to his house where Florrie was trying to sleep and playing music, playing the piano very loudly. And at one point, when Florrie complained, Alma started playing the funeral march. It was kind of, if you like, bizarre. Anyway, Florrie finally agreed to a divorce. And in 1925, Alma married a man she always called Rats, R-A-T-Z, is a shortening of his name.
Mm-hmm.
He had a grown-up son and daughter, incidentally, with Florrie, but that's by the by. It was a marriage based on money. As Alma was to say, and I think this is an absolutely extraordinary quote, "He knew as much about me as I knew about Timbuktu. And all he saw was a smile. All he heard was, yes, darling, and no, darling."
She pursued him quite fiercely, though.
Okay. Polite society in British Columbia, Victoria, British Columbia, was rather shocked at this transformation, you know, at the end of Florrie. And in 1931, Rats and Alma moved back to Britain. And they went to live in a suburban house in Bournemouth on the Dorset coast, south coast. And it was called the Villa Madeira. Alma was, how can I put it, restless. And she started drinking heavily.
I mean, Bournemouth was a funny choice.
I agree. But it was very respectable, you see. And Rats had retired and they had... they could afford staff. They had a maid and a cook. You know, it was quite a sort of... You know, establishment.
Mm.
And she really didn't respond well. She started staying in bed until midday and then only wearing pyjamas and playing the piano or the gramophone very loudly. Poor old Rats, who was by this time nearly 68, didn't take too kindly to this. I'm not playing this down, but it is the most extraordinary menage. A precociously talented young woman who could have had a choice of young men chose the money. Okay. In 1932, it should also say that at this point, Alma was also addicted to using prescription drugs, including cocaine, and Rats had effectively become impotent. I think probably out of tiredness as much as anything. So in October 1932, Alma tries to force herself on a 34-year-old cook they've just hired. He, I think, was an intelligent chap and said, no, thank you very much, so they immediately fired him. But in September 1934, they hired a 17-year-old boy, almost a man, called George Stoner, who was to be their chauffeur. Irene, the maid, chauffeur, and they got a part-time cook. So we're talking about quite an established household. We're talking about the interwar years. The Depression is just passing. The Villa Madeira is comfortably off. You know, Alma's comfortably off. Stoner was about 5'6", blonde, blue eyes, good physique, but a bit backward at school. Not the brightest of boys, but very amiable by all accounts. And in November 1934, shortly after his 18th birthday, Alma embarks on an affair with George Stoner. This is George Stoner's first real sense of being an adult. You know, mm-hmm. Probably his first sexual experience, to be honest. He comes from Bournemouth. It was a far different time. And all of a sudden he sees himself, how can I put it, lusted after by this attractive, precocious, extraordinary, exotic woman with his talent for playing the piano. Alma, is it playing fast and loose? Well, after about 8 weeks or so, Alma says to George, oh, not sure this is working. I think the age gap's too big. But then she relents and they take off and stay in a hotel in Kensington and she takes him to Harrods and buys him a suit. It is a kind of wonderful in a way.
Yeah.
But sadly, it has a tragic outcome. And this is why this story is always stuck in my mind. On the afternoon and early evening of Sunday, March the 24th, 1935, Francis Rattenbury, Rats, is killed in the Villa Madeira. He is hit over the head with a wooden mallet. Now, Alma doesn't call the police. Alma gets the maid to call a doctor. I mean, Rattenbury is clearly dead. But never mind, the maid calls the doctor. The doctor takes one look at Rattenbury and calls the police. And a wonderful man called P.C. Bagwell arrives. Now, P.C. Bagwell is a good, upright, uniformed police constable. Alma is completely out of it. She's drinking whiskey, she's probably taken some drugs, and she makes a pass at Bagwell.
Wow, she's insatiable.
Yeah, but with Rattenbury dead, I mean, she's managed to get him upstairs, but I mean, Rattenbury's dead, okay. And then she launches into the first of a series of what she can only call slurred confessions. That she killed him with a mallet. And, well, because Rats asked me to, because he was fed up with his life. Well, goodness. That's a bit of a stretch, but never mind. PC Bagwell, by now, is completely confused. However, morning comes, and PC Bagwell searches the garden and discovers, guess what? A wooden mallet with bone and blood on it. The murder weapon. Well, I mean, not surprisingly, Alma is now arrested and indeed charged with the murder of Rattenbury. The police don't entirely believe that it was because Rattenbury asked her to do it that she beat him over the head with a mallet.
Hmm.
But then, a few days later, George Stoner, the 18-year-old chauffeur, confesses to the police that it was he who killed Rattenbury. Because, he says, he'd looked through the window, he was in the garden, and he'd recently bought a mallet to put tent pegs in. Stoner says he was in the garden and he saw Alma give Rats a goodnight kiss, and this infuriated him. So when Alma had gone up to bed, he'd gone into the house and killed Rattenbury. Well, the Director of Public Prosecutions has now got two people who've confessed to the murder of Rats, and so decides, and I think in reasonably actually, well, let's let a jury decide who is guilty of this murder. It becomes one of the murder trials of that interwar period. I mean, it was a sensation. It was indeed that sensation that attracted Rattigan, because he remembered it from being a boy, of the headlines and the, you know, crowds outside the Old Bailey queuing to get in, about the sheer intensity of the publicity surrounding it. Well, not surprisingly, Alma is painted by the prosecution in a very unflattering light. One barrister called her a selfish, designing woman and a sex-hungry vixen. She certainly stood to benefit financially, because Rats had left really rather a large pension. In today's money, it would be worth perhaps $400,000 a year.
Gosh.
A lot of money.
She wouldn't have got it if she'd confessed his murder, though.
Well, hang on, because the story gets more complex by the moment.
All right.
By the start of the trial, she'd been persuaded to retract her confession by her son Christopher, who, from an earlier marriage, mm-hmm. you may recall, and said, no, it wasn't me, it was Stoner. Stoner, for his part, refused to give evidence, said absolutely nothing at all. The judge, summing up to the jury, described Alma as an adulteress of the most unpleasant type, who the jury could not have any feeling except disgust for her. Well, they may have felt disgust, but they didn't convict her. They convicted Stoner.
Mm.
Stoner was sentenced to death by hanging. We are in 1935, after all.
Poor Stoner.
Less than a week later, not far from the Villa Madeira, Alma Rattenbury, on the bank of the River Stour, stabbed herself to death. Overwhelmed by the thought, clearly, that it was she who is causing Stoner to be hung. Stoner's appeal against the sentence, the death sentence, was rejected. But a petition signed by 350,000 people an astonishing number for those days,
mm.
to the Home Secretary, saw his sentence commuted to life imprisonment. Alma died. Stoner went to jail. But in fact, Stoner did not serve life imprisonment. He served barely 7 years, because in 1942, he left prison and joined the Royal Army Service Corps and served in France.
Did he die there?
No.
He didn't?
No. It gets even better. Stoner returned to Bournemouth, married, and had a daughter. Still living in Christchurch, very near to the Villa Madeira. In my time as writing about crime, I have met countless people who have tried to interview George Stoner about what really happened in the Villa Madeira. Stoner never said a word to anyone and didn't die until March 2000 at the age of 83.
Oh, my word. God, that's such a good story.
It is the most wonderful story. And it's a really interesting case because there are all sorts of cross currents and why would she kill herself? She's got away with it. She's going to get the money. And why would Stoner not say, no, it was her? Because there is a little twist to it. After Alma killed herself, Stoner said, I only confessed because I wanted to protect her.
Yeah, obviously. Maybe their thing was, you know, deeper than all that. You know, to him it wasn't nonsense. To him she was, you know, the love of his life.
Yes, I freely...
He'd do anything for her, even if she did reject him.
Yes.
He was obviously very beguiling.
Well, but what's so fascinating, this is not one of those cases that's full of gore. It's one of those cases in which it's a real crime of passion, isn't it? And you could still believe whomever you choose. You could believe that Alma did it. You could believe that Stoner did it. You can believe that Alma said to Stoner, you've got to do it.
Yeah. I feel a bit sorry for Rats, though, because he didn't really... He got a bit of a bum deal.
He got a terrible deal.
He had to break up with Florrie, move country, and then he got murdered just because he was boring or impotent or old.
Or whatever
he was.
Yeah. He was actually a very distinguished architect.
Well, it's a bit of a shame for Rats.
Yeah. But it is... It's a great, great case. I find it... To this day, I find it moving. And I found the play, of course, Celebre, equally moving based on the case, although it changes one or two things. But what's astonishing about it is that you can't get that sense of suspense out of your mind. What's going to happen? This is a very volatile situation.
Mm.
I mean, at one point, I think Stoner and Alma, who had a pretty fiery relationship, had to be separated by Irene the maid in a full-scale fight. I mean, you know, this wasn't sort of calm and ordered.
I can imagine her being all Miss Julie in the kitchen.
Yes. Yeah. You'll have to say what you mean.
Oh, Miss Julie's a play.
Yeah.
And she... Well, I've actually not seen Miss Julie. I've only seen after Miss Julie.
Okay.
But the general gist is there's a lady of the house who seduces...
Yeah, that's the general gist.
Yeah,
and it's not an unfamiliar scene.
And she doesn't give him much wiggle room, to be honest. So, you know, I'm sure I can see how Stoner would have been backed into a corner, and I'm sure Irene was probably just trying to protect him as he was basically a child.
Well, yeah, it was only just 18.
Yeah.
You know, really. And if you think about it, that story stretches from 1935 till 2000, 65 years.
Now we'll never know.
An extraordinary chain of events. No, it's not one of those when we have to say to each other at the end of it, oh gosh, let's talk about something cheerful. But there is something horrifying about it too, isn't it? That desire can get that so much out of control. That,
true.
You know?
Yeah.
Can you imagine yourself as Alma Rattenbury?
No, Dad, but have you met me?
Oh, well, no, I'm only saying, can you imagine
yourself? Personality-wise, no.
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 But older women do develop passions for young men, don't they?
I mean, that's... I reckon you can have passion for all sorts of people at any time.
And yeah.
That bit, I get. But it doesn't seem to me particularly if she had already tried to sleep with the previous cook...
The cook,
...who
yeah.
was fired, that it would have mattered if George was 18 or 50, as long as he was willing.
Yes.
Or... prepared to be coerced.
Or could be beguiled.
Yeah.
That's a word I like.
Beguiling.
He could be beguiled.
Mm.
And you could imagine, you know, 18-year-old brought up in Bournemouth in
the
30s.
I mean, it would be hugely exciting.
It must have been incredibly intoxicating for Stoner, mustn't it?
What a thrill.
I mean, I bet he couldn't believe it, you know. And yet, he lives an utterly blameless life. After that, never gets into any trouble with the law, absolutely upright.
I mean, it doesn't feel like it was him. That's just my personal opinion.
I to this day, I don't know. Did she tell him he had to? Did he do it and say to her, "Don't worry, I'll look after Rats and we can be together"? Did Rats really say to her, "I want you to kill me"? I mean, it's almost as if there are four or five possible scenarios, you know.
Well, there you go, the murder at the Villa Madeira. It's good to occasionally have one that's a little bit more, you know, relatively upbeat.
Yeah, but it is a fascinating case, and I heartily recommend Sean O'Connor's book.
Yeah, this looks really interesting.
Yeah, called The Fatal Passion, Ulmer Rattenbury.
I will.
It's published by Simon & Schuster.
Indeed.
And got very good reviews when it came out first in hardback. And I've got a paperback of it. But so, Mo, what does the next week or two hold?
Much of the same.
More lockdown?
Well, it's August, isn't it? So
yeah, it's quiet.
Trying to, well, mine's not so quiet. I guess it's getting busier, but relatively.
I'm busy in August, or at least relatively.
Yeah, I know. You've got stuff on every week, haven't you?
Yeah. It's made it quite extraordinary.
That is, I don't think I've ever been with you on an August where you've had stuff to do every week. Usually you find August an absolute drag.
Yeah. I'm doing a case, not for this, perhaps we might do it one time in the future, which I've done before, which is in my book, Pure Evil, about a particularly unpleasant gangster called Regan.
Not Dale Cregan. A different one. Regan.
Regan, R-E-G-A-N. In fact, he changed his name from Avery to Regan after he got out of jail from being a supergrass. He is particularly unpleasant.
Mm.
So this makes a, I have to say, Mo, Alma was a joy.
Bit of a change.
Yeah.
Something a bit less heavy.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Well, what else am I doing? I'm, reading some good books. I'm lucky enough to have plenty of good books to read.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't been to the cinema.
They're not open. Are they open?
Yeah. Yeah.
Nothing's being released, so no one wants to release anything because they don't think they'll get the figures.
Nobody will be there, no. And as ever, I've been glued to Netflix and Amazon Prime.
You must have finished Goliath by now.
I finished Goliath, yes, which I liked a lot.
I've been thinking of a few other things. Also, we're going to get Succession, aren't we, because we need to watch that.
Succession I'd much like to watch.
Yeah.
Brian Cox, whom I know a little, is very good. Very difficult. It can be very difficult.
But. I listened to his Desert Island Discs the other day. It was very good.
No, he's a very, very bright man.
Yeah, it was really interesting. And yeah. Hearing how he'd grown up, etc. Got into the biz.
Yep.
Well, that was charming. Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
If I can call it charming.
So we just ought to say thank you to all the people who help us.
Thank you to our producer, Poppy Damon. Oh, and talking of our producer, Poppy Damon, she has a new podcast coming out. She's working on a new weekly series about the murder of 14-year-old C.J. Davis. You can hear a trailer of it right at the end of this show in a minute. And you can subscribe on the stories on the Times feed.
Is it part of Times Online?
Yeah, Times and hopefully she'll put a link to it in our show notes. Yes, go over and have a listen to that.
Have you listened to Times Radio yet?
I have not.
No, I haven't. I've heard a few extracts, but I haven't actually sat down and listened to it. Got a lot of people that I like, Stig Abel, Michael Portillo, John Pienaar. Got a lot of people I like, and I'm sure it's very good.
I'm sure it is.
Yeah.
Thank you to Audio Boom for hosting us. My brother Dan, who does the music, my friend George, who drew a caricature, to Jeffrey, who does all the hard work, and to you, the listeners. Thank you so much.
Yes, special thanks to the people. We've had some absolutely touching messages this week from people saying, "Oh well, welcome back. We're so pleased to have you, and it's lovely, and we've missed you." And for us, it's incredibly nice and so warming. You know, that they're out there and lots of loyal listeners, and all we can say is thank you so much. And as I usually say at the end, good things happen to bad people, so do be careful out there.
Wrong way round.
Things happen to good people.
They do be careful out there.
I'm sorry, do be careful out there. Thank you.
CJ Davis was shot dead in broad daylight on September the 4th, 2017 in Newham, East London. He was 14 years old. The case remains unsolved.
I called my child full of beans, and I remember getting a book that actually said that, and I said, this is you to the T, calling you full of beans, because from he was able to walk or run, he was running.
I'm John Simpson, the crime correspondent for The Times. This is a special series looking at what happened that day and in the months leading up to CJ's murder. We'll be trying to find answers. We'll speak to people who have never spoken before.
I've heard 100 million stories from the media
about how CJ ended up at the centre of a simmering gang war and what happened that day.
And I've seen things online that people have bragged about shooting him.
We'll explore how a young boy obsessed with dancing rapidly slipped from struggling at school into a world of combat knives, body armour, crack cocaine and heroin. And finally, a stolen car. And a shotgun.
When you have gangs that can make a young black boy feel better about himself than society, we're in trouble.
Who killed CJ Davis? You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Acast. And now we're available on the Times Radio app, along with all the other podcasts from The Times. To download the app, search for Times Radio on your App Store.